It's time for Radio Freethinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your political scientist and skeptical philosopher. This week's wine is about the Senate, in particular, their recommendations for reform of the election reform bill. When I first read the headlines about this, I thought, finally, some sanity. There was, Senate pushes back on Fair Election Act, senators seek major change with election bill, etc. However, when I read into it, it was pretty much weak tea. That said, there were some improvements. So, let's go over the Senate committee's 9 recommendations. First, removing the exemption for calls or solicitations to political donors who have previously given at least $20 is widely thought to benefit the major parties, especially the conservatives. So why would this advantage existing parties? Well, as the bill is written, you can only claim this exemption from previous donors. A new political party, almost by definition, has no previous donors, taking all their advertising deemed campaign expense. Where the established parties, even the Greens, could have anywhere from 10 to 40% of their advertising budget deemed fundraising and not campaigning expenses, meaning they could spend a lot more than new parties can, and that's kind of unfair. Next, the Chief Electoral Officer of Elections Canada be allowed to continue the relationship with Student Vote and other electoral election programs in elementary and high schools. So this means that Elections Canada could reach out to Canadians, encourage them to vote, educate them about the electoral process, engage students in the importance of their civic duty. This may force the Conservative Party to actually engage with people, the youth, disadvantaged, the poor, etc. Perhaps 23% will no longer be enough for a Conservative Party to win a majority. Both the elections officer and the Commissioner of Elections Canada should expressly be able to inform the public of problems they uncover in the electoral system, as the agency did when it realized misleading robocalls were occurring in the Ontario riding of Guelph last election. So this, again, will make Conservatives nervous. If they attempt to repeat the shenanigans of the past, like the In-N-Out scandal, robocalls, the public will know about it. They, the people, will also be able to provide assistance, tips, a raised awareness, which could lead to more prosecutions at best, and a greater reluctance of ill-doers at worst. Next, and there's kind of a few of them wrapped up here, encourage Elections Canada to allow the use of verified electronic correspondence or e-bills as proof of address at polling stations, rather than requiring original hard copies. Who has hard copies these days? Encourage Elections Canada to put photos of candidates on ballots so voters who can't read have a better chance of understanding who they're voting for. Mandating that heads of institutions such as retirement homes, homeless shelters, and reserves issue letters of attestation about proof of address for people who reside in those places, and encouraging Elections Canada to inform those with vision loss about Braille ballots. So, it seems that the Senate, a Conservative-dominant Senate, like Harper's former mentor, Preston Manning, well, they think an election should try and to expand the number of people voting, that at least some effort should be made to make voting easier and not harder, as the current act intends. Of course, vouching would still be eliminated, along with the right of 100 to 400,000 Canadians to participate in our supposed democratic process, a thing that a government elected with only 23% of Canadian votes, well, it's a good thing for them. They also state, extending the retention of robocall records by a calling service company to 3 years from the one that's proposed in the bill. Now, this is important because the process of investigating election fraud can be a lengthy one. The investigation into robocall scandals of 2011 is still underway. By requiring this information to be stored for a longer period of time, the more likely an investigation will be successful. Of course, these investigations would be much more expedient if the commissioner had the power to compel testimony. Compelling testimony may seem like an extreme act to stop voter fraud, but it pales in this humble broadcaster's opinion to the disenfranchisement of hundreds of thousands of Canadians, the result of their plan to eliminate vouching. And for the record, it's not really extreme. In Canadian common law, you do have a right not to be compelled to be a witness in a proceeding against yourself with regard to an effect, but if you are not the person being charged, you have no such right, at least in criminal law. Have you heard of, contempt of court? Well, that's what it's for. It's when someone refuses to testify when they have possible information that is necessary. If Harper truly wanted to improve the electoral system, he would have provided a tooth of compelling testimony to the jaws of the Commissioner of Elections. But of course, what party has the most electoral investigations in recent history? Any hint? Lastly, they would authorize communications between the Commissioner of Elections Canada and Chief Electoral Officer. Okay, this one may be good or just bull. The biggest issue regarding the Commissioner of Elections Canada, the investigatory arm of Elections Canada, well, it was moved from Elections Canada to the Department of Public Affairs. That meant it would no longer be accountable to Parliament as a whole, but to a government minister, a major conflict of interest. The wording seems pretty weak to me. That said, these are only recommendations. There is no way now that the Senate to truly force the issue. And it is unlikely the Senate would force the issue, i.e., it is still dominated by, and I'm compelled to add this here, unelected, unaccountable, politically partisan appointees. Numerous critics call for either the retraction of this bill or heavy alteration. What critics? The head of Elections Canada, his predecessor, provincial election officials, former Attorney General Sheila Fraser, and more than 150 political scientists who have probably forgotten more about fair elections than Minister of State of Democratic Reform Pierre Poilievre ever knew. On the idea of democracy, it is notable that all the government amendments, as weak tea as they may be, passed, but every amendment posed by the opposition party was rejected, even minor issues. The Harper government rules like a dictator. It is notable that neither the Conservatives nor the Liberals commented on the huge elephant in the room. That's the dramatic increase in campaign spending. It seems there's an inevitable march to the pocketbook politics that you get in the United States. There have been many things this government has done that might have been vaguely veiled as not self-serving, nonpartisan, not ideological. But the Fair Election Act exposes their pettiness at the expense of the nation as anything that I could have imagined. This bill demonstrates a government determined to wring political gain from every measure, a fierce partisanship for something that ought to have been nonpartisan, their dismissal of experts who, by their virtue of dissent, were deemed enemies of the party. Now, I can't imagine a world where a consensus on electoral reform was achieved, where experts, Elections Canada, past and present, the opposition party, the nation as a whole, distilled an upgrade to democracy that might have included improvements such as e-voting, proportional representation of some form, alterations that would have improved democracy in this nation. But to hope from that from the Conservative is a misunderstanding of the Harper dictatorship. It cannot do politics any other way than destructive. It knows it can count on 30% of the voters. They hope to sway maybe another 10% by appealing to niche issues, like their vocal support for the Ukraine against Russia, or Israel against morality. If it can win this 40%, feck the majority of the 60%. And in reality, with a voter turnout of about 60%, the actual translates to a popular support, as I said, 23% of all Canadians. Under any other context, we would call that, well, at best an oligarchy, but I think dictatorship. Anything that is not doctrinal, like the opinions of people who actually know stuff, experts, they are deemed enemies of the state. Think I'm being hyperbolic? Well, this government, which is cutting funding everywhere somehow, finds more money to investigate environmental groups for tax evasion. Payback for resistance to tar sands. The Unfair Election Act is just another example of Harper government hiding political dogma behind the facade of principled politics. Just like it said for the elimination of long-form census, the farmer-elected Canadian Wheat Board, the Gun Registry, the Environmental Lakes Project. I could list hundreds of examples where the Conservatives have done petty, nation-damaging policy for ideological reasons while professing principled reasons. If you have any doubt, maybe thought this is just another one of my socialist rants. Well, an example of such blatant self-serving partisan dogmatic act like this vindicates my condemnation. It is an offense not only to democracy but to the word fair to call this Fair Elections Act. I say obviously, what does that mean? Well, various measures have been designed to discourage voting by chunks of the electorate not central to the Conservatives' election strategy. Think the youth, the poor, natives, the non-rich. The changes in financing, advertising, in the lack of additions such as compelling testimony, having complete accountability of campaign spending. You don't have to take my word for it. The naked emperor is self-evident. The government obviously dislikes Election Canada's head, Mark Mayer, who has caught out the Conservatives for various electoral misdeeds. For this, his name has been added to the enemies list. It means that those who have crossed or criticized the government and are therefore to be mistrusted, demeaned, and if possible destroyed. And we can see that people in this list, Elections Canada, scientists, environmentalists, the opposition, the Senate, the premiers, the Parliamentary Budget Office, the Wheat Board, Canada's police commissioners, Think Gun Registry, Statistics Canada, Did I miss some? Likely. Anyone who is not pure of thought is an enemy of the party. Well, there's a common thread to this sort of thing, Richard Nixon. Now, you might think that I'm being paranoid. And even if I was, that does not rule out a conspiracy to thwart Canadian democracy. I think Bond said it best. Once is a happenstance, twice a coincidence. The third time is enemy actions. Okay, so that was the report. There was another stink that arose from the Senate committee, and that was Senator Linda Frum, who actually said greater voter turnout was a conflict of interest for Elections Canada. What the fuck? For a quick ad hominem, Linda's brother David was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Yes, that Bush. Her comments that Elections Canada should not encourage people to vote sounds so out of sync with well-held democratic principles that it appears mystifying. In an editorial, Frum expanded the attack that started during the Senate committee hearings. In it, she stated that, quote, Elections Canada is a bureau with two missions, to ensure the integrity of the voting process and also to promote voter turnout. Those two missions are contradictory. You want the biggest vote total? Accept every ballot. You want to eliminate voter fraud? Eliminate improper ballots may reduce voter totals. By that logic, the best way to eliminate voter fraud is to not accept any ballots. A real contradiction is when an unelected senator claiming to promote democracy by limiting voting. She also said, in the debate over Bill C-23, we repeatedly hear the words, this is Canada and Canadians don't commit fraud. It would be more accurate to say that Elections Canada isn't very interested in voter fraud, and we therefore don't know whether Canadians commit fraud or not. She points out that about 120,000 people voted by vouching in the 2011 election. In Harry Neufeld's report, a review commissioned by Elections Canada to help ensure the integrity of the voting system, something Frum never seems to mention. Anyway, in that election, Neufeld pointed out that about 42% of those had irregularities. So we're talking about 60,000-ish. That sounds scary, and it's meant to be frightening. Why? Well, I mentioned before on the show about the concept of shock doctrine. That is, in a time of crisis, you can put forward an agenda that would never have been accepted during normal times. By trying to make it sound like there's a major crisis in our electoral system, Harper et al., they are trying to push through this undemocratic act. But what about those numbers? First, as I have mentioned before, an irregularity is not synonymous with fraud. They are largely simple clerical errors, such as having the voucher and the vouchee signed in the wrong areas. Those kind of things. Could it be fraud? In a very small number of instances, maybe, but it's yet to be shown to be a problem. Well, and if you peer into the numbers, you actually find out that with one exception, none of those votes could ever sway an election. And the exception helps prove the rule. So when an election is close, very close, as in the difference between the winner and loser is less than the disputed votes, well, then a review is done on those votes. If there are irregularities, they're turfed. In fact, in the best and only example I know of is Etobicoke Center, where the system showed that it worked. And ironies of ironies, it was the Conservative Party that was fighting tooth and nail to keep the, quote, irregular votes in because it helped them win that seat. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying the system we have is perfect. Even if Elections Canada was perfect, a first-past-the-post system is innately undemocratic. When everyone who knows anything about voting stands up and exclaims, this is not helping, this will help break the system, and the only people defending it are party hacks, well, this is a low point for Canadian democracy. Perhaps to fall even lower if this bill is actually passed. We will return after this break.
Today in the news.
And today in the news.
Today in the news.
Tired of the same few voices giving you the same point of view on the news? You're not alone. The Campaign for Democratic Media is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group fighting to ensure that our public airwaves represent more than just one voice. Canadians deserve diverse, accountable, and quality Canadian media. Visit democraticmedia.ca to learn how you can stand up for media issues.
And we're back. As part of the landmark 250th episode of Radio Freethinker, I thought I'd bring back some of the past hosts for sort of a Where Are They Now kind of segment. First, here's a clip from Chloe.
My name is Chloe Packer, and I was a host very briefly on Radio Freethinker in fall 2010. It was an interesting time to be part of Radio Freethinker in general, since there were a lot of discussions about how to keep the skeptical movement inclusive. Greta Christina had just spoken in Vancouver. The skeptic and atheist perspectives on culture and gender and social justice were hot topics, and it was fun to be around for that. And I joined Radio Freethinker because even though I had been an atheist for a while, I had just fallen into the skeptic community and wanted to become involved and happened to hear about, I think I was at breakfast, actually, sort of accidentally with one of the hosts for a breakfast that had been planned as like a skeptic social. And I left because I was still in the middle of school. I was working and simply couldn't put in the research time and didn't feel that I could make my contribution valuable if I wasn't doing any research for the episodes. So, I chose to leave. My current skeptic involvement is mostly maintenance. I try to keep reading, to keep thinking critically, to be willing to dismiss perspectives, certain perspective once I examine them, and also to remain vigilant and respectful when bringing a capital S skeptic perspective into a conversation. So my promotion is not so much as an activist, but just living it day to day, and I feel like the skeptical perspective is still not very normalized in everyday conversation, and that's that conversation that I'll have with a friend or a family member of an employer or social media interactions is what I try and maintain these days. In terms of the importance of Radio Freethinker, I think any show that debunks woo helps, especially in Vancouver. We love it here. I also think that the show's tone in terms of being unequivocally dismissive of woo claims is very important. In terms of other tools that the skeptical community could, the skeptic community, I should say, many communities are skeptical, could tap into, I do feel like we live in a culture where people form their opinions reading celebrity magazines, and they also form them on social media, and I dislike the idea of Facebook groups and celebrity spokespersons, but it does seem to work. I like that skepticism doesn't have a lot of glitter, but the issues it addresses are too important not to make use of any promotion tool possible. My sort of pet topic to be the capital S skeptic about these days is parenting. I've been working as a nanny for about 2 years and have been a Girl Guide leader for 5. And many of the parents in me produce healthy, bright children, but I can think of no other role where skepticism about one's methods and one's ability to read a situation and what other people who do the job or experts in the field say about your methods and your situation is more called for. I think this feels particularly topical in light of the measles outbreak in the Fraser Valley, which is basically a direct result of parents choosing not to vaccinate their children. So that I think is a topic that I could talk at length about, but my main message would be to remember that you are not an expert on your child, and parenting is the toughest job in the world, but it isn't done without becoming educated about it and about your child and about what the best choices are for them. Which is, I don't say to any one parent that I meet or that I know or that I work for. Most of the parents I work for are wonderful, so I've lucked out in that particular way.
Very nice. Thank you, Chloe. And next I've got a message from Rob.
Hello, I'm Rob, professional gastropod, user of silly introductions, and cognitive psychologist. I was with Radio Freethinker from the first episode till about a year and a half later, during which time I mostly talked about science stories and occasionally did pre-recorded segments if I had an idea while traveling abroad. Generally, I try to be friendly and keep things light, though this sometimes led to my making horrendously bad jokes. I'll try and keep those out of this segment. I think the most memorable show for me was early on when we interviewed Jerry Armstrong for our Scientology episode. This frail, unassuming man came in to the studio, and we didn't really know what to expect. And when we got him into the studio, he told us about this unimaginable abuse that he suffered at the hands of the Scientologists just for leaving the church and questioning its actions. And he was a member of the Sea Org, and sort of now lives in exile in, I think, Chilliwack or Hope or something like that. Another bit that was really interesting was when we went to a giant psychic fair in the convention center, and we interviewed just about everyone we could get to talk into the recorder. And we milked this material for about 4 shows, and there was some really good stuff, like a guy selling books about cosmic energy and he openly insulted me by calling me a black hole, and you could tell that he was being really snarky. And there was also a chat with a lady who I think was selling homeopathic aromatherapy, which I guess doesn't smell like anything. So the show started when we were at a meeting of the UBC Skeptic Society, and Elin suggested we do a podcast. I was just one of the people who raised their hand. It was very ad hoc, and I don't think we did anything until after James Randi came in to give a talk about a month or two later. We decided to get in touch with his booking agent, and I couldn't believe it when they actually said yes. Like, I didn't think that the show was going to happen, but there it was. So we wrote up some questions, and we set a date over Skype, and then proceeded to have nearly half an hour of total trouble connecting. So when it finally started working, like an idiot, the first question out of my mouth was, "So why were you so eager to be interviewed by us?" And Randi sort of paused and was like, "Eager? Why, I've been waiting for 30 minutes!" And it was really awkward. So basically, every single show we've done after that was to try and make up for that travesty at the very start. Ultimately, I left the show because I got into graduate school in England. I got my master's in cognitive and decision sciences, and now I'm in the final year of my PhD in the psychology of magic. So over here in England, skepticism is pretty darn active. I used to live a short walk away from the Monarch, which is where the flagship Skeptics in the Pub meets. And there's also CFI and the Central London Humanists and loads of other Skeptics in the Pubs groups in pretty much every borough and county. The QED convention just happened in Manchester, and of course it's also the home country of Chris French, Richard Wiseman, and Richard Dawkins. I still promote skepticism, sort of. I give talks on the basics of psychology or my research to the various rationalist groups, but I do it more so for science promotion and communication than skepticism. I think that organized skepticism in particular is kind of a clusterfuck of people not really knowing what to communicate well or run organizations, even if the people at the grassroots level are well-meaning. Plus, it's usually the same old stuff, like, there's only so many times I want to see a talk about UFOs. So, ultimately, I think that understanding our own problems will take us further than spinning our wheels about these same topics, but then I would say that as a psychologist. So, Radio Freethinker. I always liked the way the show wanted to explicitly apply critical thinking and evidence-based reasoning to a broad range of topics, not just the usual stuff. And hopefully some people took that on, but ultimately it's up to the listeners to decide if it's helped. I don't necessarily think that capital S skepticism should be promoted. It's probably more useful to promote a sort of general stance that any claim can be checked in some way. I've chosen to do this via science communication and teaching students at university, but there are probably other ways. So, a final thought to send out over the airwaves. Look outside your comfort zone and be humble. Critical thinking applies to everything, even ourselves. So I urge people to read up on the psychology of reasoning and find out what people actually find convincing. And here's a hint, it's not necessarily evidence. So thanks for listening and happy 250th episode.
Thanks, Rob. Now, recently Daniel and I sat down and had a chit-chat. So let's listen. So, just to start things off, for those who are new to the show, how about you say some things about who you are, what and when were you part of Radio Free Thinker?
Yeah, so I was part of the original group that started the show back in 2009. Back me up here. It was 2009, right?
Not I believe it was when it first started, way back when.
Yeah, whatever it was a long time ago. So for the first few months of the show, I was the tech guy doing the audio system in the background, not actually talking on air. But after Elon, one of the other original founders, left, you all convinced me to finally start contributing on air, especially on the social science and economics topics. And I ended up staying on the show until 2011, I think. Like almost full time until 2011, and then a few sporadic episodes after that. And for who I am, at the time I was on the show, I was studying economics with some other social sciences thrown in for good measure. And now I am back at UBC studying computer science.
Cool. So you were actually part of the original original group, right? Because Radio Free Thinker was originally sort of an idea that came from the Free Thinkers Club, if I'm correct.
Yeah, I remember Elon had some sort of meeting with the club, and one of the ideas people had for what the club could do was a radio show or a podcast or something along that line. And eventually we decided that CITR, the campus radio station, you're listening to the show on there, so I'm sure the listeners know what CITR is. But they basically had a lot of support for anyone who wanted to create a show, so that seemed like the best avenue for us to be heard.
It was funny, too, because I remember, I don't think I was actually part of the Freethinkers Club. It was like they send out a sort of a bulk email when you sign these stuff. So although it sort of originated in the club, it really was sort of an independent thing almost from day one.
Yeah. After, basically, like, the year after Radio Freethinkers started, I became, I would say, somewhat the head of the Freethinkers Club, not in actual title, but the president at the time did less than me.
The power behind the throne.
Yes. And like the radio show pretty quickly separated from the club, even with like me being involved in both.
So during your time at Radio Freethinker, what was the best thing that happened? Be it, you know, sort of your best time on air, the most impact. If you were to tell anyone that you were on the show, what would you regale them with as your best thing ever?
Well, the thing that I liked about my time on the show the most was constantly having lots of new topics to research and to learn about, and then coming in and getting to talk with very smart people and Don. I'm just joking, you know.
No one on the show is very smart.
Yeah, it's true. And so that was always interesting. One thing, I actually went back and re-listened to this in prep for our talk, is we had a discussion on traffic and urban sprawl back in 2010, I think. And I basically made some predictions in that. It was one of my favorite shows because I think it's actually one of the social science topics that there is actually like quite a bit of evidence that you can bring in. Some are quite fuzzy, but this one I think has pretty solid evidence. And so I thought it was a good talk. I could have presented it better, but it wasn't too bad. But I did make a few predictions, which I want to very quickly talk about because I'm actually kind of happy I was wrong. I predicted that with the new Portman Bridge, that it would have, on average, it should have, within a couple years, it should have a 40% increase in usage. But in actuality, it's gone down 3%. I'm very happy I'm wrong here. What I got wrong at the time was I failed to take into consideration how much of an effect the toll would have.
Cool. One of the things I've noticed, and I don't know if you noticed it, but I think you have. When you first joined the show, you were somewhat, I hate to use the word naive, but perhaps, I mean, our listeners, of course, regale at the number of times how we went head to head over your sort of libertarian sort of points of view versus my, you know, hyper-communist sort of points of view. But I noticed over the years, your view about this has evolved quite a bit. Do you think the show helped you in that, or was that the outside world changing you?
I think being surrounded by skeptics, people on the show like you and all the others, certainly was a pretty large reason that I moved away from libertarianism.
Yeah, well, so Daniel, let's maybe bring this bit to a close. Is there any final words you'd like to give to our audience? Anything you'd like to say?
I don't know. My number one thing to skeptics out there is don't be afraid to wade into the softer sciences. They're not always full of greatness, especially economics, but I think it's so vitally important these days to the lives of people that we are more thoughtful and we really think more about how policies of government affect our everyday lives.
Excellent. So thank you, Daniel, for revisiting us here in our Radio Freethinker virtual studio.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing me back for this. We'll definitely need to do like an actual topic again at some point.
Will do. Now, sadly, due to unfortunate circumstances, Jenna could not make this landmark show in person, but she did send a message that I thought I would read out. From Jenna. When I was part of Radio Freethinker, I was Jenna Cappy, PhD candidate working in the Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology at UBC. I started contributing to Radio Freethinker to contribute to the scientific literacy by, hopefully, translating complex scientific information into more accessible information. My goal in this was, and continues to be, trying to help people understand the way things really work, which makes believing in alternative truth less necessary and less appealing. I left the show because of a shifting priority and the schedules in my life. I completed my PhD, I got a new job in the biotech field, shortly thereafter got married. You can find me now as Jenna Mocha, and moved to the burbs. I don't really know if I can comment on the state of skepticism in my current situation. Working in a scientific field and as a communication-driven department, I tend to be surrounded by people who are critical thinkers by profession, by habit, and by association. This means the ratio of critical thinking to other thinking is higher, but it does not mean that this translates to everyone or to all times. As far as promotion of skepticism, I don't know about that either. I guess it depends whether the question refers to the movement, the community, or the thought process. Within my peer and family groups, I am often, and often inappropriately, socially speaking, compelled to debunk advice or admission being doled out. Likewise, I often downplay the coincidences that people around me find meaningful, if pressed. To me, this is encouraging people to recognize and uphold truth as is currently understood. I strongly believe that this has the effect of leveling the playing field and decreasing societal ostracization and strife, as well as physical and emotional suffering. I hope to find time in the near future to be more concerted in my efforts through scientific communications. My goal is to encourage as many people as possible to appreciate the wonders of the natural world and human scientific achievement by helping them understand the amazing mechanisms through which everything functions. What would I like to tell the world? I would say that fear, hatred, and complacency spring from ignorance, and not always willful ignorance. If we understand more, we can't help but hate less and empathize more with people, with progress, with ourselves, and with each other. I stand by my old sign-off tag. The real world is amazing, and there's no more wonder we need to inject. It's an endless well of exploration, and it's fun to do. Thanks, Jenna, for that. And let me thank Chloe, Daniel, and Rob for participating. I'd also like to thank Ethan, who tried to join us but due to illness could not, as well as Elon and Rob, who could not meet with the time deadlines. I hope to have some time for them in the future. Thank you all for making Radio Freethinker the success it is today. We'll return after this break.
Subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreethinker.com.
And we're back. So as a final treat, I thought I would recast the very first episode of Radio Freethinker. It's like stepping into a time machine. It also shows that, like life, talk shows evolve over time. So this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
All right. Well, that was very interesting. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the first live edition of Radio Freethinker, the UBC Freethinkers radio show on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. So the Radio Freethinker is a radio show promoting skepticism, critical thinking, and science. We examine popular, extraordinary claims and subject them to our critical analysis. These claims may fall into the categories of religion, alternative medicine, conspiracy theories, supernatural claims, or any other popular belief system that doesn't have the evidence to back them up. We're also, it's important to us to promote the idea that skepticism does not equal cynicism. Here's a little quote we came up with. The real world is a beautiful and fascinating place, and we want people to see it through the lens of reality, as opposed to superstition and non-evidence-based beliefs. So with me is my panel of distinguished free thinkers, starting with Don.
Hello, everyone.
Rob.
Hi.
And Ethan.
Hey, everybody.
Today, on our inaugural show, we're going to talk about quite a few topics, including some things that our supposed authorities are saying, like the Pope and the Canadian Science Minister. We're also going to have our interview, first part of our interview with James Randi. But first, we're going to head over to Don, who's going to talk to us about the dangers of smoking marijuana.
Hello, everyone. Yeah, so everyone's, since kindergarten, has heard about how dangerous marijuana is and how it'll kill you if you have it. If you have too much of it, or if you even get near it. Well, we're going to investigate some of those claims and some of those things that they say about it. I think, really, there's three ways to look at this. First of all, pot. Is there anything good about it? Well, California has legalized medical marijuana because it has lots of medical uses. Some of them actually quite surprising. Did you know you can use medical marijuana to help reduce the effects of Alzheimer's? Who thought? Tourette syndrome. There are a number of things that it's good for. In fact, I just heard on the news the other day that Barack Obama has instructed the Attorney General, thank you. That's our tech guy helping me out here. The Attorney General not to arrest people in California for distributing medical marijuana. There was a big debate between the state law that allowed it and federal law that didn't allow it. So, medical marijuana. It does some good things. But still, you hear about a lot of bad dangers about it. Some of the dangers. Addiction. Most studies have shown that there's no physical addictability of marijuana. You can't get addicted to it physically. Now, there are some studies that show that there is psychological addiction, but psychological addiction goes with pretty much anything. Anyone who has a favorite toy that they just can't get rid of, that's a form of psychological addiction. And that tends to be about 5 to 10% of the population.
Don, what about the people who say that smoking marijuana will lead to other drugs which are addictive?
Yeah, oh, it's a gateway drug.
The gateway theory. Actually, that's quite interesting. Some studies have shown that people who use drugs in general will go on to use more drugs. But people who use marijuana exclusively, or relatively exclusively, have no greater danger of going on to gateway drugs. Although there are some things with the legalization, which we'll talk about perhaps in another episode, that will lead to that. But actually, studies have shown, with regards to how people are socially adjusted, how marijuana itself can actually be beneficial to you as opposed to a harm. A study in Switzerland showed that people who smoked marijuana alone were far more likely to be well-adjusted, get along with their friends, have bigger friend groups than those people who didn't. And more importantly, those people who did marijuana and tobacco. And I think that's where you're going in with the gateway drugs. Some people have addictive personalities. People who have an addictive personalities will tend to use drugs in general and become more addicted. So if you do marijuana, you do alcohol, you do tobacco, then there's a chance you might do meth, you might move on to other things. It's not the pot that makes you leads the gateway, it's just your own mind.
So marijuana is sort of like a social lubricant, sort of like going out for drinks at the pub with your friends.
Yes, actually, and ironically enough, far less dangerous than that shot of vodka you have.
Right, so let's get to that. Like, is smoking marijuana damaging my my brain cells, and is it going to lead me to an earlier death?
No.
That was easy. Let's move on.
No, there has been no evidence of long-term damage to normal users' brains. So people who are, you know, do a joint, maybe a couple of joints a week, something like that, do it recreationally. There's been no study that has shown conclusively that it can lead to any damage. Now, those people who are heavy users, and we're talking people who smoke anywhere from 70 to 300 joints a week.
Okay.
Those people actually have had some minor health issues, but they were minor health issues.
Also, they probably don't have time to eat.
No.
Don, can you actually overdose on marijuana?
Well, you know, we've tried very, very, very hard. But no, actually, to be fair, and because this is a skeptic show, right, you know, a part of us wants to say we like pot and pot's kind of good, but to be fair,
not me, Mom.
there is a toxic level of marijuana. If you have roughly 120 grams of pure THC in your bloodstream for an average person, right, that can be a lethal dose.
How does that compare to cigarettes?
In order to get that into your bloodstream, though, it's been figured you'd have to smoke about 1,500 pounds of marijuana in about 15 minutes. Now, granted, if you made it into brownies, that might have been a bit better. Compared to something like, alcohol, for example. Alcohol, really all you would need to do is about 10 to 15 strong shots in an hour. And then you're beginning to reach...
Which I think has been done before by some people with dangerous results. The Century Club comes to mind.
No, exactly. Actually,
big, thick Russian guys.
And you get similar toxicity for nicotine. We were figuring out today that if you put a number of nicotine patches on your body, doable. It's a number, but it's doable. You could actually OD on nicotine. And caffeine, 7 liters of espresso can cause some people to die under 3 hours. Now, granted, you'd be going to the washroom a lot, but hey.
I guess.
But no, that going into, sorry, with what else we were saying is death rates. There are no death rates for marijuana. No one has died from marijuana.
So I guess all of those things we were taught as kids with those public service announcements, this is your brain on drugs, no one's had their brain smashed with the frying pan yet from smoking marijuana. So interesting to be skeptical of what we're told about that. Let's go to a public service announcement of other things. Welcome back. So as I said before, you're listening to Radio Freethinker here on CITR Radio. If you enjoyed our discussion that we just had about the potential dangers of marijuana, you might want to listen to part two of our discussion of this, which we'll have next week, where we're going to talk about the law and the potential legalization of marijuana that some people discuss. But anyways, on to a completely different topic. The Pope has been saying some interesting things lately, and Ethan's going to fill us in on what he's been telling his followers.
Well, thanks, Elon. So the Pope has been making some pretty interesting statements lately. It started with, on January 26th, the Pope de-excommunicated a bishop, Richard Williamson, who is actually a Holocaust denier. And it's important to recognize that he wasn't de-excommunicated because he was a Holocaust denier, nor was he initially excommunicated in the first place because he denied the Holocaust. He was a leader of a schism of a very conservative branch of the Catholic Church. And it's been noted that this is sort of a very odd move, because is not the Pope now endorsing this particular bishop? And if he is, what does that say about the Catholic Church right now? So, the response has been immediate and very far-reaching. Jewish groups such as Yad Vashem and the Israeli Jewish Agency have condemned this. The Vatican has been in fire control mode nonstop. They've been going around and saying how the Pope is not a Holocaust denier. He does not endorse Holocaust denial. But I think the issue here is, why wasn't the Pope aware of this? Why did he even do this if he knew that there was a problem?
Actually, you know, I find it kind of interesting, too, that the Pope is willing to reverse excommunication based on some theological point, but he's not going to excommunicate him because he's a Holocaust denier. Denying millions of people's death, oh, that we can allow. But to sit there and say that you're a conservative Catholic, oh, well, that will kick you out for it. There seems to be a certain level of hypocrisy there.
Yeah, there is. And it's quite troubling when you think of the fact that Benedict, he is German. He grew up in the 1930s. He was in the Hitler Youth Association. You think that he would be a little bit more aware and sensitive to the issues of Holocaust denial, but apparently he isn't.
Well, it's not really much of a stretch to assume that the Catholic Church is sort of out of touch with reality.
That's one of the points that
Well, let's get on to the next thing to see as an example of that.
Well, yeah, another really big thing the Pope just did is he was in Africa, and he made the statement that condoms not only are not helpful in preventing the spread of HIV/AIDS, will actually increase the risk of spreading HIV/AIDS.
And so this is without any scientific evidence to support his theory, correct?
There is zero scientific evidence to state that condoms actually increase the spread of HIV/AIDS.
I think there's probably been quite a few studies that have shown it to do the opposite.
Yeah, many, many studies that show that. And it's this kind of anti-science statement is just so wrong. The Pope is making a moral judgment. He's a Catholic. He disapproves of birth control. That's fine. A moral judgment is his business.
Well, that's even something else to discuss. It might not even be fine,
well,
considering...
Well, he's not making... I mean, he's making a moral statement. That's fine. But he's making it an ethical statement. He's basically saying that using condoms is wrong. It should be a criminal offense, is what he's basically saying. That is unacceptable.
Right, especially with all the people in Africa dying of AIDS. It's basically an epidemic of AIDS right now, and it doesn't help.
This statement could lead to many people dying.
I wouldn't even cut him the slack of saying it's even a moral statement. The Catholic Church has been losing adherence all across the world, with two exceptions, Africa and South America. And Africa is its big growth area. And part of this is the idea of a conspiracy of white people going against black people. They're using the old colonialism thing, and that this is somehow a plot by the UN or the EU to somehow reassert the domination of it. And the Pope is kind of playing into this in an effort to try and get people to look at the Catholic Church as a stalwart for protection. It's I think a much of a political ploy as anything else.
Yeah, so I guess the thing to learn about this is the Pope, just like anyone else, you know, it's important that he examines the scientific evidence before making a claim, especially if it's something dangerous that a lot of people are going to listen to and potentially be harmed from. Speaking of people who are sort of saying things that are anti-science, this is surprising. The Canadian science minister actually was just asked recently if he believed in evolution, and he answered saying, "I'm not going to answer that question. I'm a Christian, and I don't think anybody asking a question about my religion is appropriate." His name is Gary Goodyear. Basically saying that asking a question about if evolution is real was a religious question.
Well, that's pretty ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah, considering all the scientific evidence supporting evolution, like if he doesn't believe in evolution, that basically means he doesn't believe in the scientific method and science.
It's kind of troubling to have a science minister that doesn't trust something that most scientists agree on.
Has anyone asked him about gravity?
Gravity's a theory, too.
Or maybe something about if the world is round or flat. There's lots of evidence to support all these things. It's really scary because, you know, he's the one deciding funding for various agencies and groups. And, you know, especially in a time of a potential recession where, you know, money is tight, we want to make the most informed decisions about science and, like, what we're going to be trying to do.
It almost makes you wonder if something like this, if Richard Dawkins was voted to be Pope. You know, I mean, there seems to be a certain minimum qualification for certain jobs. And
yeah, there must have been some
belief
question.
In science should be something the science minister should be in favor of.
He was appointed, though. He didn't pass a test or anything for this.
Well, a political test, I'm sure, but...
I'd be interested to see if he's a close personal friend of the Harper family.
Well, either way, I guess the thing that we just need to know is now that we know that he is... you know, has his viewpoint, we have to be very careful and watch about the types of things that he's going to be instituting as, you know, as part of his role. Just keep a close eye on him, I guess. All right, now I guess we're going to go to a station ID made by Strong Bad. All right, so you're listening to Radio Free Thinker on CITR Radio. Thanks for sticking with us. Over a month ago, James Randi, noted skeptic and magician and the founder of the James Randi Educational Foundation, he came to UBC, he did a talk here, and then he granted us an interview, which we've split up into three parts, and we're going to play part one of his interview right now. And note, Rob started the interview, and note the awkwardness at the beginning. I think it's quite humorous.
So just to start off with, we were curious why you were so eager to appear on the show. What is so important to you about skepticism that you're so willing to promote it?
I'm so eager to appear on the show.
Why are you so quick to promote skepticism? Why do you think skepticism is so important to promote in the world?
Okay, that's a better question. Because if you're not skeptical, you will buy things that don't work. You will invest money in things that will lose your money. You will make mistakes. You'll flounder around, and you'll perish. It's obviously much healthier to be skeptical and about things that deserve skepticism. You know, the presence of water in the bathtub can be tested very easily. You don't have to get in very gingerly in case it's sulfuric acid or some such thing. Things that are doubtful, you should be skeptical about them.
Okay, so how do you decide what to be skeptical about, and who can you trust? No one can be skeptical of everything, but it seems like there are some things that are really easy to be skeptical about, and some that are tricky, or what do you think?
Well, if someone is trying to sell you something, be skeptical. If someone is trying to sell you on an idea or a product or a service of some kind, investigate it before you invest. That's being skeptical, skeptical in a healthy way, I would think, and in a productive way. If things sound very unlikely to be true, then that's something else you should be very skeptical about. And don't judge things if you don't have the expertise to do so. You see, the so-called psychics are very successful with scientists in many cases. The reason for that is that the scientist, as soon as he or she achieves a PhD, they assume that they know everything and they can no longer make any errors. And that is not often the case. As a matter of fact, we've had an easier time, we magicians, down through the years, an easier time entertaining PhDs than entertaining children, because PhDs assume that they know everything and that they can't be deceived. But that's not true. They're more easily deceived. The more intelligent someone is and the better educated they are, often the better the scam artist has in deceiving them, because they make the assumption that they know everything.
So scam artists sort of prey on the fact that people make these assumptions.
That's true.
How do you draw the line between someone who is a charlatan, someone who is trying to exploit the assumptions people make and their confidence they have in their beliefs, between a charlatan and someone who is delusional, someone who truly believes in these claims? Where do you draw the line?
Those that thoroughly, honestly believe in the claims are, as you said, delusional. The others are maybe delusional as well, and maybe scam artists and trying to make money from it, but there are people out there who know full well that what they're doing is a scam, and they're taking advantage of people's naivete and lack of experience with the real world. But you can't tell which one is which until you really get into the thing. I've often said, people say, oh, but this person did a reading for me, and the reading was so accurate and such. Well, that's a matter of judgment. It may or may not be, but you cannot assume that these people are either honest or self-deluded. You cannot decide that in many cases until you have experience with it. But I've often said that someone like John Edward or Sylvia Brown, who do these readings, in some cases more or less successfully, they can't be doing it by accident. It isn't just chance, because you can't give a man a violin, a man who has never held a violin before, and say to him, play Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto, and have him do it. You have to know what you're doing. And Sylvia Brown and John Edward and these other scam artists have to know what they're doing, and they have to work it very carefully. You can't walk a tightrope without doing some practice and knowing what you're doing either.
So for the general public, it seems that what, you know, they don't think too hard about the claims that Sylvia Brown and John Edwards make. How do you explain skepticism to someone who isn't a skeptic? How do you teach someone to be skeptical of these claims without coming off as arrogant or talking down to them?
Well, people should realize that they don't know everything about everything, and if they do, then there's no hope. You just abandon them. You walk away from them, because they're determined they don't want to know about this sort of thing. But you simply tell them that they can easily be fooled, and you can even prove it to them in some cases. So I'll give an example to your audience, if you wish.
Sure.
Well, I'm going to ask your audience out there, and if possible, I would like you to actually think of this very carefully and quickly. And Now, hold on a second.
Sure.
I just got to get rid of this ringing phone here. Will someone take the phone, please?
Busy at the JRAF?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Always. Always. I'll do a little bit of experiment with your listeners and with you, too. And I'd like you to either confirm or deny. This is an experiment that works generally on audiences, and I've often done it.
All right.
I would like you to, I'll give you three different general categories of things that you can think of, and I want you to have the three of them in your mind when I finish, and then I'll try to guess what they are. I want you to think of, a color, a flower, and a piece of furniture. Okay, you got those in mind now? Do you have those in mind?
A color, a flower, and a piece of furniture?
That's correct, yes. Think of an example of each one of those, okay?
Okay.
All right. I think that you'll find that upon investigation, most people thought of red, rose, and a chair. How close was I?
That was pretty close.
I had rose and chair.
Yeah, I had rose and chair as well. And how about you, Ethan?
Yeah, I had rose and chair as well.
All right. Now, the color that people almost always think of when you ask them to name a color is red. The second one is green. But most people think of red. But when they say red, what follows almost automatically is red rose. See, because you think of a rose as being a red flower. Red rose. And think of the third category. Now, how many different pieces of furniture can you name? Chair, table,
couch.
Sofa, okay. Couch, whatever. I've almost run out. How many pieces of furniture? You know, an armoire, a desk, yes, but pieces of furniture are scarce, really, if you have to specifically name a piece of furniture. People don't think that that's a subclass that is so sparse in specific examples.
Okay, so there's this sort of implicit association that people are making. Okay.
Yeah. And people tend to do that. And there are other things I could do if I were visually in contact with you that would show you that I can suggest these things to you. And I can do it in a way that you won't necessarily solve that it's being suggested to you.
All right, thank you. I have some questions from my co-host here, so I'll pass it off to you.
So, Mr. Randy, this is Ethan here. I was just going to ask you, regarding the claims of psychics, have you ever had a psychic admit to you, perhaps privately, that they are in fact a con artist and that you're making their life very difficult?
No. It would be refreshing to find this, but I have had a couple of people over the years who have tried to do an imitation of our famous Alpha Project, where we sent two young fellows who are just amateurs in mentalism, that is, mental magic, so to speak. They were amateurs at it, but they had a pretty good knowledge of how it was done, and we sent them into a parapsychological lab. I guess that was 1987 or so, in order to fool the PhDs that were there, the scientists, because the scientists decided to trust them. Scientists trust photons and crystals of copper sulfate and various things like that, because these things don't turn on them and deceive them. But the kids were sent in there in order to show that these scientists could be fooled, and the scientists were thoroughly fooled, accepted them, and were prepared to turn out a scientific paper on the subject. But we had agreed in advance, the kids and myself, that we would reveal.
So that was part one of our interview. We're going to get you to listen again next week to hear part two, which is very interesting. And that's about it. That's about it for our show. So please, again, listen to us next week. This was our first live episode, and we'd love to hear your comments and questions. If you could email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com, that would be great. Let us know, like, what you liked, what you didn't like. And now, to close out the show, we're going to have a quote from Rob. So, Rob, take us away with a quote.
In the beginning, the universe was created. This has made a lot of people very angry and has been widely regarded as a bad move. That's a quote from Douglas Adams, author of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and noted skeptic and atheist.
And that's it for our show. See you next week. Thanks.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
To the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond.
This is Raymond here.
This is Master the Light.
Howdy, folks. We're the Bitterweed Drawn.
This is Zach from Black Breath.
Hi, this is Audie from Broken Bones.
Hello, Vancouver. This is Carolyn Mark.
I'm Water Crime Guide.
This is Dan Mangan.
Hey, this is David Pepke from Denmark.
This is Dylan Ozick from Slingshot.
Hi, this is Dick Valentine from Electric City.
Hi, everybody. This is Fred Penner on the Radio Waves.
This is Fred Schneider.
This is Colin from GBH.
Hi, this is the Gearing Up Inventors.
Hi, this is Bette Ditto from The Gossip.
Hi, this is Brian from Hellshock.
This is Scruffmouth the Scribe.
I'm Shani from Inepsy.
This is Sab Gray from Iron Cross.
Hey, we're J plus J plus J.
This is Jack Mercer from Jack Mercer and the Whiskey Bandits.
It's James Wood. Half of Mega Bear.
This is Jeron Paxton, American musicianer.
This is Swami Bill and the Shameless Weed Hounds from New Orleans, Louisiana, east of the Mississippi.
Hi, this is John Boutte from New Orleans, Louisiana.
This is Jesse Laborde.
I'm Peter Mansbridge.
Hi, this is Ron McLean of Hockey / Movie Night in Canada.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, also on the web, CITR.ca. In UBC, University of British Columbia, in Vancouver, Canada. Have our people contact your people, won't ya?
Sob skank, Scotty spanks butts. He skanks when he struts. No one told him never to be rude. Boy, he dresses like a gangster.
He wrestled with an hamster.
He's here to get you all in the nude.
Boys
and girls.
It's not just this scene while it's showing your radio.
It's scenic drive.
Scotty's Scenic Drive, Monday, 11 a.m. to noon, 101.9 FM, CITR Vancouver.